Hey, and welcome back to Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. My name is Mark Pattison, former NFL player, now climbing the seven summits. Actually, I've done six. I have one to go, Everest. And welcome to another amazing pod. Okay, I've got this great quote. I got this super great quote from Muhammad Ali. Okay, I never thought of losing, but now that it's happened, the only thing is to do it right. That's my obligation to all the people who believe in me. We all have to take defeats in life. And this guy this week on the pod is Terry McDonough. And this is an incredible story. And this guy has had more lives than you can possibly imagine and things that have happened to him. Anyways, he is the son of the former journalist, also one of the original guys on NFL Today, Will McDonough of the Boston Globe. And Terry was a football star way back when in Boston, Massachusetts, little suburb outside of there. And he was involved in a car crash. And this car crash involved the death of a friend. There were six or seven of these kids in the car. Life was great, high school football. And anyways, he was just going too fast and a lot of bad things happened and one thing happened after another. And Terry really had to fight through a series of setbacks through life and to mask the pain. He did that with alcohol and some pills. And ultimately, he had to face his fears. He did. He went through that and now is and has been for quite a long time sober, well and alive. He is an NFL executive for the Cardinals. And so he's been in the scouting game now for a long time and he thrives in that. So proud of what this guy had to go through, endure, and then actually come on the pod and talk about it. And that takes a lot of flipping guts, and he did it. So we'll get more to him in just a minute, but you know, really heartfelt and warming pod. So that's Terry. And as always, if you want to find out what's going on with me, you can do that at markpattisonnfl.com. Speaking, climbing, e-learning course, books, the whole thing. It's all there, and I'm really fired up to hit Mount Everest, as I said, in about 11 months and counting, okay? And loved his public speak, did that last week out in Florida, and it was super fun, okay? So if you haven't also done this, please go to my website via iTunes and rate and review. It super helps. It helps you elevate in the world of Apple. And that's what we all need is more inspiration from people about things they've gone through and where they are today in terms of overcoming those things and being in a much better place, just like Terry. Okay. And finally, I'm jacked up for a new sponsor we have on the pod, Cascade Mountain Tech. There's more about that company inside the pod you will hear about. So stay tuned for that. And on that note, let's go listen to Terry. Here we go. Hey, everybody. It's Mark Pattison back again with another very, very deep, and this one is going to be emotional podcast. And, you know, I found out about this guy, Terry McDonough, a while back. I read about his story online. I'm part of the NFLPA. And so we get newsletters, and I think it came through that. And it was just this story of somebody that had literally crashed and burned, and some tragedy came out of that. And then on the back end, I think the story is all about redemption. And really, at the end of the day, I don't think there's really anybody out there, if you've lived long enough where something hasn't happened to you, it certainly has happened to me. And I've had to, you know, go through that, and what that is also what is led me into the mountains. But we'll get into all this. Let's start off by welcoming our guest today, Terry McDonough. How are you doing, Terry?
Great, Mark. It's a pleasure to be with you today and with your audience.
Yeah, no, listen, this is going to be a heavy one. And again, as I said before we went live here, that I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story, being brave and being authentic about who you are and kind of what happened to you. So I guess, you know, I've teed up the obvious, which is like, hey, what happened? And so
to me, this is one of these stories where you almost want to start with the cliffhanger and then kind of like in the thin air, we can go backwards and kind of reset this stuff. And then, you know, we'll fast forward kind of where you are today, because I think it is a fantastic story. I think it's so intriguing and there are so many elements. And as I also mentioned to you before, most of the time when I have these people on my podcast, and I've had some incredible folks on with no arms, no legs, or blind, you know, going down the Colorado River and doing amazing things. And I've never written so many notes on any one of my guests. So, you know, it just is what it is. And we all have our own path, and you've emerged out of yours. So let's go back to 1982. And you, I believe, were a junior in high school.
Correct. Yeah, you know, you're a football player, so you know high school football starting. You're on top of the world. I just finished my junior season of football. We went 9-1 and you know, had a pretty girlfriend and life was pretty good. But, you know, I was on the outside. Everything was great. You know, I was a popular guy, football star, baseball star, all that good stuff. But on the inside, I was a young man that was full of a lot of hurt, you know, from a lot of things that happened during childhood. My mother and father went through a divorce when I was 8. And, you know, and a lot of people have to go through a lot of tough stuff, but this is my story. And, you know, my father remarried a woman when I was 11 or 12 that was 17 years younger than him. He was 42, she was 25. And my dad had custody of the three of us. My mother left, battled with alcoholism before my father got married. My aunt, who was my hero, she was a Roman Catholic nun, came over from Japan to take care of the three kids. And, then my dad got remarried, and it was just chaos, Mark, from pretty much age 8 to really when the accident happened. It was different families. A woman came into our home. My dad fell in love with her. They started their own family. I think myself, I was the youngest. My sister Erin was a year or two older than me, and my brother Sean was a couple years older than that. I think we felt pretty alone during our early teenage years. So I was mad. I had red hair and freckles, and I acted out, whether it was playing football, playing in baseball, getting in fights. But, you know, outwardly, I was, you know, thinking I was a big, bad jock. But inside, I was the furthest thing from that. I was incredibly insecure, lonely. I had a lot of self-doubt of who I was, what I was, you know. So I had a mask on. And it all came to a head that night in December 29th, 1982. It was myself, my girlfriend, her best friend, a girl named Leslie Messina, two of my buddies that were on the basketball team with me at the high school I went to, and then two sophomores in the back of a 1981 station wagon. And where I'm from up in Massachusetts, hockey's the big sport. And I was driving. It was my girlfriend's friend's car. We had all had a beer or two, except for the girl that passed away and her younger brother and friend. We picked them up right before the accident happened. And I was driving fast and too fast. We were late for the hockey game, and it was a couple miles away to the rink. And I went down a long, winding curb. I was actually no excuse, but I was from the other side of town, so I really didn't know. Come from a pretty good town, you know, square mile wise, and wasn't familiar with the roads. It was a cold winter night, and was probably going 50, 55 miles an hour and a 35, and I went around a corner and just veering a few inches off the road. But up north, you know, the telephone poles are right there. From that point forward, everybody's life changed. The girl that passed away was my girlfriend's best friend. Her name was Leslie Messina. And she was the prettiest, smartest, nicest, most athletic, kindest girl in our high school. A couple other kids got hurt, but they recovered. And from that point forward, Mark, it changed a town of 23,000 people. I don't know if they've ever gotten over it because it affected so many people.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack here. So the town I think you're talking about is Hingham, Massachusetts, right?
Yeah, they pronounce it Hingham. It's a suburb right on the ocean, probably 15 miles south of Boston.
Okay, got it. Okay, so that's number one. Number two is, and just, you know, full disclosure, you come from a pretty famous family. Your dad was Will McDonough, longtime sports reporter for the Boston Globe. And then he went on and what was it? NFL Today, CBS.
Yeah, he was the first of his kind. Now there's a lot of them, you know, the Peter King, Chris Mortensen, Adam Schefter. But back then they didn't have a guy that could, you know, that was back when you were playing. They didn't have internet. There was no way to access information. So if you're sitting on your couch in Los Angeles, you looked at the local media, but you had no idea what was going on in Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia. So what they decided to do, Brent Musburger in the mid 80s brought him in and said, okay, we want you to tell us what's going on around the league for a 10-minute segment, you know, pregame show every Sunday. So they flew him up there, and he did. You know, all he took all his information that he gathered during the week from all the different sources, coaches, GMs, and, you know, people were about to watch the 1 and the 4 o'clock games for the NFL, and there he was saying, okay, this is what's going on in Detroit. This is what's going on in L.A. This is what's going on in Pittsburgh. So he was the first of his kind. Now there's a bunch of them.
Yeah, so what you're talking about is being a sports insider. No, I totally get that. And
yes.
then you're you've got a couple of brothers, but Sean is a guy who I know has gone on to great fame in terms of broadcasting. Very good at it. Been doing it a long time. I know him through my good friend Hugh Millen, also a Patriots.
He was a great guy. Yeah, very good man.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyways, there's some, when you start talking about your dad ended up divorcing your mother, I totally get that from the standpoint of that there's a lot of dysfunction there. And something that I think you tell me, but, you know, didn't happen all that much, where the dad actually gains custody over the woman, the wife. And that's what happened in your case. And then, you know, a couple of years later, your dad ends up marrying somebody. And so, you know, like you said about acting out, you know, it's just something that, how do kids process that kind of information? It's hard. And everybody goes through different things. And the other thing too, again, let's go back to the crash. It was horrific. You know, obviously this is not you. We all, me included, are all young and dumb from the standpoint of you've got all that testosterone flying around. And you think you're king of the world and we're playing a gladiator sport and football. And I have done, along with all my other buddies, done just as stupid things, not to that extreme in terms of the end result, but it just in terms of driving too fast and other, you know, beers in the car, those types of things where, you know, I could never turn around and point the finger because we were there. We just either didn't get caught or, you know, something bad didn't happen on the other end. But in your case, you know, you pack all these things together and it just turned out to be a very explosive event. Crazy.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the factors that were involved, first of all, the girl that passed away, I mean, she was, every town has a girl or two that's just special in every way. She was a best athlete in the town for an art age group. She was a straight A student, came from a tremendous family. Every person Leslie met, she made them feel like they were the most important person in the room. She was a hero, you know, and she was my girlfriend's best friend. And so the magnitude of what an incredible human being she was, plus the bear in the car. So the photos of the accident. One of my friends told me to slow down right before it happened. So it was who my father was. So it was a very, and it's a town of 24,000 people, nothing to that magnitude had happened. So it was just, it was for, it, to this, you know, I'll say this, I was in an airport. It happened 37 years ago. And I was in an airport probably 5 or 6 years ago. And I saw someone with a Hingham jacket on that was, looked like 10 years younger than me. I might've been in my mid 40s. And this woman was 30s. And I think I was in Dulles Airport. And we were talking, having a good conversation, and I told her my name. And I had never had anyone look at me that was from my town that didn't know me. Once I told them their name, look at me and say, oh, wow, I'm so sorry. Oh, wow. And she said, oh, nice to meet you. I said, yeah, you grew up there, right? She goes, yeah. I said, well, my name's Terry McDonough. She said, oh, that's great. And for the first time, she didn't know who I was. And I felt a huge sense of relief. And so I'm like, okay. And I went back there a couple of years ago, and it's been three and a half decades. And I'm like, okay, it's different now. I don't have to walk around here with so much shame, which is what I did for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's you're 1 minute you're the star, and the next minute you're the villain. I think I read, you know, you actually were quoted as saying something like that. And at the time, when all this went down. And again, you're 17 years old, you're in this car, you guys are out just looking to have a great time and with some good buds. And next thing, it's all good. It's all good. And then in a second, it goes all bad. And the police officer coming up to you and saying, you know, at some point in time, maybe by the time you're 40 years old, you will forgive yourself. And to have that guilt, to have that shame, and then have all those people, you know, it's like a constant reminder of when you walk in that town. And I'm talking about immediately right after the first day that you went back to school post the accident, to walk in that classroom and to sit down and to do roll call, and all the kids, all the parents, all the teachers, everybody knows your story. And it's not a good story. I mean, we all want to be liked. And I mean, things turn for you in a blink of an eye, literally. And so I mean, the obvious question is, how did you deal with that? I mean, and then before that even happened, you had these explosive things happening with your mother, between your dad and your mom, this new woman that comes into your life. Is she going to take my dad away? I mean, that's a lot of stuff for a kid to pack in.
Yeah, and I remember when I went back there that Monday, I was going to the bus stop to go to school. See, the accident had happened on Thursday of winter break. So, you know, I have a week off over Christmas and New Year's, and you have to go back to school. And, you know, I'd always felt like a big shot getting on that bus, and I'll never forget saying, I don't know what's going to go on. And I didn't realize the extent of the reaction. I thought there'd be some anger, some sadness, but I remember thinking people would maybe put their arm around me and say, hey, man, it could happen. No, it was 99% when I walked down the hall, it's like the seas parted. There was not a lot of support there. And I felt very, very, very much alone. And I had to put on a brave face. And it was hard. It was very, very hard.
So was anybody there for you?
Well, my biggest supporter was my aunt who raised me, Sister Mary Martina McDonough. She's a Roman Catholic nun, and she gave up her career in the convent. She went over to Japan after World War II, and she came back. She gave up her career. She stayed a nun, but to raise my brother, and my sister, because remember, my dad got custody of us. It was 1974. I was 9 years old, and as you said, my dad got custody, not my mother. And if I could back up for a minute, Mark, it's, you know, here I am 9 years old. You know, you have certain events you remember when you were 8, 9, 10. You just remember them for some reason. Yeah. And I had to go in the courtroom, and I walked in this room, and there was a judge there with a big black robe. And he looked right at me, and he sat down. I was 9. And he said, there's something you need to tell me right now. I need to know, who do you want to live with, your mother or your father? I'll never forget it. It's a hot summer day. And I looked right at him, and I said, sir, I can tell you without a question, I want to live with both. And he said, he paused and he looked at me, said, no, you don't understand. I said, you don't understand. I want to live with both. So that was the end of that conversation. I wasn't even 10 years old. And then I walked out, and then my dad got custody. But that was, that was hard. And the whole thing was hard. But the beauty of working in the NFL is, you know, guys, you played with guys I've scouted. A lot of people have been through a lot worse. Some of these players, I just have such an admiration from, just to make it out of the neighborhoods and get out of to play professional football. It's pretty amazing.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think where your focus goes, your energy follows. And when you're trying to emerge out of something that's very difficult, and you have your focus on a certain goal, and some of these guys that you just mentioned, some of these different NFL players that you scout, you know, that is the goal. That's the way that they can emerge out of some of these different places. So, you know, that's their story. But back to you, I can't imagine in a grown adult, especially somebody that's educated like a judge, to sit there on a 9-year-old and throw that kind of question down on somebody, on really anybody, but a kid, thinking that that's a good thing to do, and that kid is not going to have some, you know, repercussions come back on them in terms of as an impact on what decisions like that can do. I mean, essentially you were saying either pick one or the other, and you're saying, no, I don't want to do that. I want to be with both. Like any, I'm sure most kids would be towards their parents, and it's just absolute double jeopardy and traumatic effect. You know, I got to tell you, I'm one of my roommates, guy who played at BC, Boston College, guy that was on the line for was the guard, started offensive guard for Flutie. was a guy by the name of Steve Turpillo. I don't know if you ever knew him.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. My good friend played with him, Eric Lindstrom. Played at the rival high school. BC was where I always wanted to play. And when Flutie was there, they were rock stars. They were tremendous. He's my age or a couple. He was a couple years older than me.
Triple. Yeah, exactly. And so I think, so you and I were a couple years apart. And he might have been 2 years. So there might have been 4 years between you and I right now. And Steve was 2 years behind me. And so when I got down to New Orleans, we ended up becoming roommates and good friends. And here's this guy from South Philly. These are the types of guys that you used to hang out with. And, you know, I mean, I know from my experience and being around his buddies, these were tough dudes. And beyond that, I mean, it was like they'd open their jacket and like, hey, Marky, what do you want? You know, it's just like it's a different way of living. Yeah. Right? And so I can certainly understand when you're going back in, the very opinionated people. And when you're going back into that high school, you've just had a tragic event happen. And now what you're hoping for is somebody just put their arm around you and say, hey, you know, it's going to get better and I'm here for you, versus turning their backs on you. And then, you know, you wipe all this other stuff into it and you mix it with a small town and everybody knowing who you are, it gets pretty, pretty darn difficult. So you merge out of this and then you have to go to trial. You have to go through all these bad things and you end up being sentenced. You go to jail for 7 months. I mean, I've got to ask this question to you because I've interviewed a couple guys who have been in some pretty hardcore prisons. I imagine yours wasn't that hardcore, but at the same time, you know, you're incarcerated. It's difficult. How did you deal with that? What was that like for you?
You know, I was still 17 when I went in there. So, you know, it wasn't an 18, it was the county jail. And you're right. It is not a prison. They don't have guard towers. It's just, a typical county lockup where people that are doing sentences from 3 months to 3 or 4 years. But it's still, you go in there and there's still bars and you have to sleep in a cell. And they're not the nicest people in the world. But if you want my full honesty, relief. Because it was a lot easier in there than it was in Hingham for me. And in a big sense, I knew it was an accident. I didn't mean to hurt anybody. But I did inside of me knew that I wanted to, the Messina family, Leslie's family, wanted to see me incarcerated. So it was just a relief. Let's get this over with. It's never going to be over with. But I'll go do my time. I'll get away from this town. And I was young. I was 17, and I didn't know any better. But I knew I wanted to get out of that town. I didn't want to feel alone anymore. And I felt just fully, totally alone in Hingham. And like, you know, there was 24,000 people looking right at me.
Well, yeah. And the other thing about that too, I'm sure it was it's a tragic event, and nobody wins. There's not a winner. There's not a loser. It's just everybody in the food chain. It's bad. Somebody loses a daughter, a friend, you lose a lot in that whole process too. You end up going to jail, your parents, your dad in particular, your brothers, you know, the whole thing is difficult to go through. And I can only imagine. So ultimately though, you merge out of that and you go to UMass, and now you're finishing high school, you're going on to college. And it seems like you're merging your way out of this whole thing, and you're getting to this next place where you need to be in your life. Now, at this time, did you know that you wanted to have a sports career?
Yeah, I did. Now, of course, like, congratulations on making it, because you're the 0.1% of us that have that dream that actually do make it. Yeah. So it's such a rarity. So congratulations on
Thank
that.
Thank you.
That shows me. But what I did is I still had good, my knees were still pretty good, and I got out and I lifted weights the whole time I was in this jail, but I still had to earn my high school degree. So I went to a 1 year PG up in Maine called Bridgeton Academy, which is a pretty good football school. It's a unique concept. We play a lot of the JV teams for small colleges around New England. And I tore my ACL third game of the year against Springfield College. So the one thing I had hope to hold on to is I could play sports in college. And as you know, because we're the same age group, back in 1984, ACL was a year, and it was a serious deal. So the scholarship, playing football or baseball my freshman year of college, I was still going to be in a cast. So now I didn't have that. So when I got to UMass Amherst, which still in the state, but it's in the western part of the state. People still knew who I was. I was out of Hingham, but I wasn't out of the state. I remember one time when I was a freshman at UMass, I was interviewing for a little telemarketing job. And the guy said, okay, what's your name? And I said, Terry McDonough. And he just looked down and he said, wow, man, I'm so sorry. So that was, it's just because I wasn't in Hingham, I still had a huge inferiority complex. So what did I do? What do kids do in college when they don't feel good about themselves?
They start drinking.
I drank.
Yep.
And I drank and I drank and I drank to try to numb myself. And I was so lost. And I was had a girlfriend at the time. We were, it was the summer of my sophomore year, probably back in 1987. And we were in Long Island, New York, having dinner. In the summer, we were going out to her parents' house out in Montauk. And I thought I was having a heart attack. And what I learned later was it was post-traumatic stress syndrome. Basically, I'm not a doctor, but I don't know really much about it other than when you have a traumatic event, war, death, a serious car accident, your mind and body goes into this immediate protection mechanism. And one night, sitting there, my mind and body kind of came out of that protection mechanism. So for the next year or two, I battled some real severe symptoms of post-traumatic stress. Most of it's anxiety, couldn't breathe. You know, it was a horrendous feeling because I didn't know what was wrong with me. I went to every doctor in the world. And finally, I checked myself into a place called Braintree Hospital in the middle of my college for a couple of weeks to find out what was going on. And that's what it was. Kept on drinking and doing drugs to medicate myself. I got sober my junior year of college, ended up graduating in 1990 and went on to start a career in football. And yeah, to get back to your question, Mark, absolutely. Because, and my father told me when I was 15 years old, we were driving home from a Boston college game. You know, from Trapillo was probably playing for him then. And
yep.
He was a sports writer. And I remember turning to him saying, Dad, what am I going to do when I grow up? I'm a sophomore in high school. And he said, you're going to be an NFL scout. I didn't even know what an NFL scout was. And I said, what's that? And he told me. I said, why do you say that? He goes, because every time we drive home from the Patriots games, you tell me, Dad, I think this guy can play, that guy can play. This is why I think he's good. And he was right. So I've been one of these for 28 years, and it's been a tremendous experience.
Hey, this pod is sponsored by Laird Superfoods. So many products to choose from your Instafuel, your coffee, your tea, your smoothies. And I love the superfood creamer and use the hydration powders like the beets, the coconut, the matcha, the turmeric to mix all into my 7 Summit smoothie. And it's so good. Log on to LairdSuperfood.com and get your 20% off when you use the code MarkP20. Okay? So get your Laird Superfood and I guarantee it will help fuel your journey.
So let me ask you this question. And this is, it's kind of an obvious question, but I wouldn't be asking you this question if I didn't know the answer. So, you know, obviously your mom, and I'm putting words in your mouth and you can dispute this, obviously, if you'd like, sounded like she was an alcoholic. And so,
yes.
You have alcoholism running in your family. My dad, by the way, told me, my dad's since passed about 7 years ago, but he had told me years and years and years ago that my grandfather, so his dad, suffered from the same disease. So he was telling me that just to give me fair warning that, you know, this thing can flow in the family and just to be self-aware. And so when you've gone through all these crazy things, right, your mom, basically you having to make the choice between your mom and your dad, going off to jail, blown out your knee, this image problem, the divorce of your mom and dad, and then leading to drinking and this post-traumatic stress and anxiety and all these other things that are racking up on your, you know, within your body and in your mind and soul and everything else. When you're drinking like that in college, are you self-aware that you're numbing the pain, or you're just not there? I mean, how does that work?
It's a good question. I knew to answer your question, yes, because here's why. A lot of alcoholics, one of the main things, or at least I can speak for myself, is even before you take your first drink, I think a lot of people, again, I can only speak for myself, you want to medicate how you feel on the inside. You know, it is a disease. It's not a weakness. And it's, you know, it's a disease and it's passed down, as you said, generationally. Some people don't have it. Most of the times it's genetic. You're genetically predisposed. And yeah, I believe I was an alcoholic before I took my first drink. Even if I had a perfect childhood, I still think once that liquor hit my lips, I wouldn't know how to stop. So yeah, it was totally, I didn't feel like, again, I felt like a pariah because people knew who I was. And even people from other states who didn't know about my story, inside I was like, well, if they really knew who I was and they'll eventually find out, they won't care for me too much. So I had very, very low self-esteem.
So like a lot of people, they mask it with food or destructive behavior. And that was that was your vice. I mean, that's what, and that's, by the way, I mean, you're not alone from the standpoint of a lot of people doing that. One, two, in college, it's what a lot of people do. Hey, let's go to the party. And what do you do at the party? You drink and you have fun and play drinking games. And you go through that whole phase, and some people know where to cap it off and level out, and other people just keep going. And so where was that for you, where you're able to ultimately become self-aware and to turn that switch off and to get help to deal with the situation?
Well, I don't know how self-aware I was, but I had no way to get out. I had very few friends left, and I found some guys, this was in right while I was still in college, that I think went down to Atlantic City, New Jersey, and for the July 4th weekend, and here we are, a bunch of, you know, jocks down in Atlantic City, and first day was great, had a great time, wonderful night with all my buddies, went back the next night, and boom, I got so drunk, I didn't know where I was just wandering around, and I ended up getting arrested for just being stupid. And I had no place to go, and no one was going to bail me out. Finally, I got bailed out under the, the assumption that I was going to go get help. So that's the first time I got sober, was in 1988. I got out of there and graduated from college and didn't have a drink for about 6 or 7 years. Got into the NFL, had 3 kids in 3 years. Hadn't forgiven myself yet. I'm still living in all this pain. So I started using alcohol and pills again to kill the pain that had never left. And this is in my early 30s, 30, 31, 32. The last time, Mark, I've had a drink or a pill of any kind was February 12th, 1998. So that was 21 years ago. And yes, I have forgiven myself. It took a long time, but I'm in a good place right now, and I have been for a long time.
Well, as they say, one day at a time. I've got buddies who have gone through the same type of thing. Yeah, it is literally one day at a time. And you know, climbing up the mountain, you know, one step at a time as you continue to go up that mountain. And we're always climbing, right? I mean, I, you know, the name of this podcast is Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And I say this frequently, but, you know, it really should be called Finding Your Summits, because we all go up and we go down and we go back up, but you're always climbing. And I don't think there's that ultimately that only one Mount Everest, the pinnacle, that's it. And then, hey, you know, high five. Life is over. I've got things, you know, by the tail, because things and stuff, they're always happening. Things are always changing, and you got to be ready for change. And that sometimes it can be personal. Some of that times that can be your association with certain events, you know, your job right now with the Cardinals. And it's just the way life goes. And I've had plenty of mine. So as you emerge out of a lot of this, your dad steps in, I think, and helps you get a job as an intern, you know, not probably doing a whole lot compared to what you're doing today, but it was your first entry into the NFL. And that was being an intern for the 49ers.
Yeah, it was Bill Walsh for the internship. And it was to finish up my college degree at UMass. And I was sober at the time. Never been to California, went out there and just helped out in any capacity I could. It was one of the greatest teams of all time. As you know, you were playing back then. They won the Super Bowl by 45 points that year. And one of my duties was to go out and watch Joe Montana and Steve Young play catch every day. So I said, this is what I want to do. And it gave me, I said, you know, Marcus, okay, everything that's happened, I found something that I love. People don't know me. I'm on the West Coast. They don't really know the story. So I can begin to feel like I could not have to walk around with shame.
Yep.
If that makes sense. I was 22 years old, 23 years old, and a lot of just developing relationships with people who weren't judging me and who I was and what I had been through. So I felt like, okay, I might have a shot at this thing. It was a great experience. And then that ended, and lo and behold, the World League of American Football,
don't know if you remember that back in the early 90s. We went on to become NFL Europe. Started and they hired me and a bunch of other young guys, didn't pay us any money, but that was another great experience because I went over to Barcelona and worked for the Barcelona Dragons, and we had a good team for a couple of years. And then the next year, Bill Belichick became the head coach of the Cleveland Browns, and he hired me as a full-time scout, and I was probably the youngest full-time scout in the NFL at that time. I was 26 and still sober, and my professional dreams were coming true.
Hey, I'm excited to introduce our new partner of the pod, Cascade Mountain Tech, an outdoor brand from the Pacific Northwest, which is where I'm from, that offers a great selection of trekking poles. They're incredible. Super coolers, camp chairs, LED lighting, and much more. Right now, Cascade Mountain Tech is offering 15% off your first order by using the code FINDINGYOURSUMMIT15, that is, FINDINGYOURSUMMIT15, when you check out at CascadeMountainTech.com.
So where? Okay, so I'm gonna fast forward just a hair to only get into. I'm not sure if the right word is a relapse, but there is. So you're sober.
It is the right word.
Okay, so you're sober for a number of years, 7-8 years, and things seem to be on the right trajectory for you going up as a scout in the NFL. You're being hired by these amazing head coaches and these organizations. And where was it in there that things started to go sideways?
Well, I stopped working on myself. What had happened is in 88, I got sober. 89, I did the internship. 90 and 91, I worked in the world. 92 in Cleveland. Met a woman, dated, had three children in 3 years, got married. All of a sudden, okay, I was in the NFL. Now I have children. So now I have, my life isn't important anymore. I got to do it for them. And I realized, okay, but their mom and I got married quick. It wasn't, think about what she had to go through with me, what I was still dealing with. I was a mess. So I good things started happening in my life. But I had not forgiven myself. I was inside. I was still empty. And eventually I started back drinking again and doing prescription drugs. And because I was still inside, just dying. And I had a huge, they say, you talked about food. People want to fill that void.
Yeah.
My void was a crater. And I had a relapse. And then in February of 1998, I got sober again and haven't had a drink since. So my kids were 3, 2, and 1 at the time, and I was a mess. I'd go to these schools, go out at night, get drunk, go back to my room, pass out. And finally, in the combine, in scouting combine in Indianapolis in 98, I was out all night, and they found, everybody knew. I said in the article, the gig was up. It was up, and I thought I was going to get fired. And I thought I was done. She was my ex-wife was divorcing me. The kids were little. I thought I was Mr. Modell. Art Modell was going to fire me. And I never thought about suicide before, but it started creeping into my mind. Do I really want to go through this anymore? And I went back to Baltimore. We were the Baltimore Ravens, and I walked in there, and all I was doing was praying, please, please, God help me. I don't want to feel this way anymore. And then he looked right at me and he said, I'm going to give you one chance and one chance only. And then that day I went back to rehab for 30 days, a place called Father Martin's Ashley. And I knew it was my last chance. So every day in those 30 days, I walked into the chapel, I got on my knees, and I just kept on saying, please help me, please help me. And I've been fortunate. I haven't had a sip of alcohol or a drug since. That was 21 years ago.
So I think the guy you're talking about is the owner of the Cleveland, then Baltimore Colts, Ravens.
Yeah, Baltimore Ravens, Cleveland Browns, and Baltimore is correct.
Yep, Art Modell. So I was this last week. I was doing a public speech back on the East Coast, and I got up there, and we get midway through, and what I said is that I had been working with a personal coach not too long ago, and he challenged me to think of some different times that had a major impact on my life where I sit today. And so I thought about it for a while. And I think we can all say that. It's really one of those times when you are asked to choose door number 1 or door number 2. And one can have a catastrophic effect sometimes, and others can be the best decisions of your life. And I'm sure you made a lot of decisions like that along the road that went, that swung in both directions. I do believe, though, that based on reading your story and now talking to you, that one of those times in your life was on one side going to the combines, not being in the right state of mind, and everybody, you know, really the wrapping came off the gift in terms of everybody really knowing that you had a problem, and then having to once again face that. But then Art on the other side, the owner of the Ravens, giving you one more chance and sending you off. And, you know, since that day, it's been a lifesaver, because who knows what would have happened to you if he hadn't given you that chance to go and have redemption to where you stand today, not having a drink in 21 years plus. So, I mean, I would think that would be certainly a big, significant impact moment in your life.
Yeah, you nailed it. Because if he went the other way, I wouldn't be talking to you on the phone right now. And I wouldn't be here probably. And, you know, my children, I have a phenomenal relationship with the three of them. Again, they were 3, 2, and 1 at the time. Now they're 25, yep. 24, and 22. And what an amazing last 2.5 decades we've had together. I've been remarried. And it's been the one thing I said, we were in those group counseling sessions, you know, when you're there for 30 days. And what they try to do is rehab you emotionally. You know, because the drugs, the alcohol, the food, whatever the addiction is, sex, any kind of addiction you have is trying to fill something inside. And the thing that can fill that is God, and then you feeling good about yourself. Like, I know every time you climb that summit. When I was watching your show the other day and I saw that gentleman with no arms and no legs, who am I to quit when he never quit? Yeah. He had to come overcome a lot. You know, so you get inspired in so many different ways. But my children, I broke down, and my kids were 3, 2, and 1. I broke down and I said, I want to be a dad. I wanted a chance to be a father. And, you know, in that article that you read, when, you know, my son Brendan said, I've been nothing short of a sensational dad.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome.
I can't tell you how much that means to me.
Well, you have been. I mean, look, let me throw out something else too that I really have a strong conviction on is that I believe that we all take certain paths in life, and sometimes they're not all, you know, a straight shot to the moon. There's, you know, zigzags that you come along. I call that traverse. And when you traverse, you have to zigzag through life. And what's really important to me, I have two girls, one's 20 and the other one's 22. And it's really important for me to create a legacy in life so that they can look at me and say how proud they are versus somebody getting to a certain age and then retiring. And, you know, you've overcome. I'm looking at these things. Like I said, you in the I've interviewed the most amazing people, some famous, some not, but everybody's got these, like, you did what? You got eaten by a shark. You have no arms or legs. You know, you're the kid that played for Jake Olson, that played for USC last year, that is the first blind long snapper.
What a great story. I saw that. What an amazing story.
Yeah, he's been on the pod, you know, talking to Shelly Smith. I'm sure you know her. You know, she's had breast cancer. Yep. I mean, there's this one person.
She's an amazing woman.
She isn't amazing, but all these people, and you too, you're amazing. And
thank you. And you are too. I was so inspired when I saw what you were doing, the Seven Peaks. Have you finished them all?
Now we've got Everest coming up, but I just want to finish this point. The point is that,
sure, go ahead.
that the you know, creating a legacy, and I think you said it beautifully, which is, you know, where your focus is, and your focus now is raising kids and believing in God and just focused on your job and your wife and things that really matter in life. And that helps you get through these tough times. And also at the same time, whether you realize this or not, you are creating a legacy and a legacy for your kids to follow in your shoes and provide the right roadmap and the vision board for them to be successful in their lives. And I'm sure that's the reason why your son said that beautiful thing about you. You know, essentially he's saying, my dad's my hero. And at the end of the day, through all the hell you went through, you showed up. And, you know, I'm here to salute you for what you've accomplished, where you've been, and this long list of things of from dealing very, very early on with your mom. And you know, I mean, you're dealing with some lot of heavy stuff here that most people in their life, you know, you've got like 10 things on your list. And, you know, maybe somebody has two or three or one or whatever their number is. And to try to bounce back and now you're in this player personnel position down with the Phoenix Cardinals, and you're just a phenomenal evaluator of talent proven over time and up for these different GM jobs. I mean, it's just as I started at the very beginning of the show, I think it's just a great story of redemption and, you know, somebody that a lot of people can look up to.
Well, thank you. And for a long time, people have said, I spoke to some small groups here and there, but never really. And people said, you're wasting a platform to help people that feel, you know, despair in their life. And so I finally agreed. The writer, Ian O'Connor, called me a couple of years ago after a bunch of other guys, well-known guys, wanted to write it. And I just didn't feel comfortable with it. And finally, I said, you know what? It's time. And not that I was hiding, because I became peace. I had a lot of peace within. But I didn't realize it would have the impact. And Ian O'Connor told me, and said, Terry, I think I was born to write this story. He's a phenomenal writer. He just wrote and he's a good, better person. So we bonded, and he told me, he said, it's not going to be what a great guy Terry McDonough is. He said, it's going to be hard hitting and truthful, because the real story needs to be told. I said, I have no secrets. And I didn't even ask him at the end. I didn't say, oh, we can write. No. And I gave it up to God. And I've had a lot of people contact me through social media, which I'm not very, I need to become better at, just saying, hey, thank you so much. I went through this, or, and 99% positive. So there's been some healing with it, but more importantly, it'd be a great opportunity for me to give back to people and not waste an opportunity, maybe to save a life or who knows what.
Yeah, look, man, accidents happen, situations happen. And I think if you can be your true authentic self and really come from a place of truth and coming from a place of truth, I think the strength really comes out and other people really feel at that point in time to start sharing and opening up their story, because you've been so brave to do that. And you're not doing that, as you said, to put on a show. You're doing that because that is what has allowed you to heal in the right way and to move your life on and be a positive impact to other people and your kids, you know, moving forward. And so, I mean, it's just it really is a absolute incredible story. So as we sit here today and your star points in the northerly direction, how does that look for you? Obviously you're down at the Cardinals. You guys just had the first pick. I'm sure you had some say at some level. Well, you obviously did in terms of all the draft picks, not just your top quarterback, but anyways, just interested on where you see your roadmap going. Where do you want to go with the NFL? Is it ultimately to become a GM?
Well, it's funny, because you think people, to fulfill their destiny in life, they have to be the CEO, the president, the GM. I've been the number two guy at two different places for the last decade. So from a work perspective, I've been satisfied. If God wants me to become a GM someday, I will. Yes, I'm the number two guy. I'm basically the assistant GM. But what I've done is, my daughter, as Caroline, has cerebral palsy and autism. My oldest son, Patrick, works in the NFL. He went to Notre Dame, graduated, works for a great organization, the Baltimore Ravens. He's living his dream. My younger son, Brendan, the one that I get choked up over when he said that, went to Georgetown. He was just a second-round pick. He actually plays professional soccer right now in the MLS. And they're both boys are just tremendous human beings. They got a great love of God, and they're great to people. And I've been really blessed to have them as my children. But my daughter is my favorite, Caroline. She's in between the two, and she has cerebral palsy and autism. She's a special needs student, and she's living in Charlotte with her mother and a caretaker. They split time, and I went into my boss's office after the draft, and I said, Steve, I love it, but I need to go be a dad. So we're going to move back to Charlotte here. I still with the Cardinals, have a great role, but instead of being in-house, I'm going to be able to
live in Charlotte, right by Caroline, still scout the country for the Cardinals and be a big part of the structure, but I also get to be a part of her life on a daily basis. And for the last 5 years, I haven't been because I put my career first for my children, but now it's time to go be a dad.
Listen, I can totally relate. My daughter has a form, my younger daughter has a form of epilepsy, Amelia, and there's been a lot of challenges with that and continues to be. And when I climb Mount Everest 11 months from now, I'm doing so in the name of the National Epilepsy Foundation. So really trying to help pay it forward on some of the things I've been able to accomplish and raise money and awareness and help her in any way I possibly can. So anyways, it's just going to be, it's going to be an amazing thing to do. And she's an amazing person. And I have so much respect for the battle that she's going through, just like you have with your daughter. So I think we're two birds in the same boat. And, you know, you just got to be the advocate for your kid.
Do me a favor. And when we hang up, send me the site where I can go to donate for that, because I want to say something about you. I've never met you, but there's a parallels between my journey and your journey. I mean, and here's what it is. All these peaks you're climbing and you can barely breathe and you're in 40 degree weather and everything's telling you to quit. Every part of your body, your mind, your heart, and your soul, and you don't. Yeah. So as inspiring as I could be on this phone call, just think about all the people that want to quit and you're at 18,000 feet and you can't breathe and you don't quit. Let me ask you a question. Why don't you just turn around and go back?
Oh, gosh, that's probably a deeper question, you know? I mean, seriously. And I think the short answer, and then there's a deeper answer to this, but the shorter answer is that for some reason, we all have our different paths. And even though that things went fairly well in high school, I had to battle, and it took a number of years for me to emerge. And I remember some alumni that I'd gotten a full ride scholarship at the University of Washington, and we were at a practice, and maybe I was a freshman or a sophomore, and I could overhear him talking what a waste of a scholarship I was. And and so then I ultimately worked my way. I mean, there's nobody that worked harder than me running those stairs in Husky Stadium on rainy nights when the lights were off and nobody was watching and there's no cameras, nothing else than me. And ultimately, that pyramid of success that Coach James had taught not only myself, but obviously the entire team really resonated with me, and I followed it and I got drafted by the Raiders. And then I can remember many of my friends came up in my face and said, "You'll never make it." And I had all these naysayers. And I was never a star NFL player like Jerry Rice, but I did go to the combines, and I was a seventh round draft pick, and I am in the NFLPA. I'm part of the club. I played 5 years, and now I have these different mountains. And again, it just kind of gets back to what I had to do to emerge out of a very dark place that I was in 7 years ago, my dad passing away and my longtime now ex not wanting to be married anymore, and breaking up the family, was to retreat to the mountains. And through that, I just found no matter what, especially this happened on the first mountain in Kilimanjaro. And on summit day, I just crashed. So when I did the porter that I was climbing with, he jammed a protein bar and slapped me around and hit me a few times in the face. I had got back up and I made it. And it was just like, I know if I can get through up on this mountain, I can get through anything in life, kind of some of like things you were talking about. And from that point on, I just put the blinders on and has made this mission. And while at the same time raising a whole lot of money towards different causes to help different people out. And, you know, it's amazing what has come back my way, especially on this podcast, which would have never have happened if I hadn't stepped into the fear in the first place. And I think, you know, again, sharing parallel stories here. And so that's, you know, that's a lot of it. I mean, there's a deeper probably element to that, but I mean, that's kind of the top line story.
It's funny you use the word mountaintop, because that's literally what you're doing. But one of the questions in the article Ian O'Connor asked me, he said, you know, your brother Sean was an announcer for the World Series and he did Monday Night Football, and your brother Ryan is the general manager. Do you ever think you'll see your day on the mountaintop? And I didn't even have to pause. I said, every day since February 12th, 1998, I've been on top of the mountaintop.
And that's the thing. See, that scared young boy, the one that had to go in and tell the judge he wanted to live with both, and the frightened young man that had that big hole. Once you fill that hole with love and God and confidence and belief in yourself, unbelievable things happen. You see people have transformations every day in their life. And that's what I had. And I did have a lot of good people that were there for me. But when I got on my knees and I said, God, please help me, it was the most amazing day of my life. And ever since then, I've been on top of the mountaintop.
I love that. Well, look, this is a great way to end the pod. We started off, obviously, on a lower note and describing some pretty traumatic things in your life. And now you're on a mountaintop and you keep, you know, pointing higher and higher and higher and elevating and really sharing that love going out. And I so appreciate you coming on, sharing your authentic journey. And I wish nothing but the best for you and your family going forward.
I'm going to follow you. I can't wait till you get to the top of Everest. Please send me for your daughter's foundation, and you stay in touch if you need anything. And yeah, if anyone that hasn't Googled you online, do it. It's quite an inspiration. And I'm a big fan of yours. And let's stay in touch, whether it's, let's just make sure we stay in touch.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, yeah. No, the pleasure is all mine. So thank you so much.
Okay. Best of luck to you and all your listeners.
Thank you.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye. Hey, thank you so much for dropping in and listening to another amazing episode of Finding Your Summit. Truly incredible people doing spectacular things in life, and I hope you were inspired just like I continue to be. Look, I am super grateful that you came in and subscribed to this pod and would be more than appreciative if you gave the show a ratings and review on iTunes. Trust me, it matters. And then also go share it with your friends, of course. Okay, until next week, go do something great, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.